that war machine did not work well with squeaky wheels. The war machine worked well where everybody just forgot about their own feelings, their own fears, and just were willing to work and be disposable. And women gave us the same message. Lois Lane had no interest in Clark Kent, who expressed feelings. She only had interest in Superman. Now, once she found out he was Superman, then she thought she could add to him by helping him express feelings. But zero interest in the person who expressed feelings without first being Superman. And, you know, and you see this in, you know, movie after movie and theme after theme and in real life.
Yo, what's good, everybody? This is Hafiz, and I hope you guys are having a great day today. We are back with another conversation, and I had to bring you somebody who is such a pioneer in helping men grow, helping men develop. Man, there's so many people in this world who are doing amazing things for men, and if we were going to be having any form of platform that helps men become the best version of themselves, we had to bring this next guest. So please, without further ado, welcome to the show, the one and only Warren Farrell.
Happy to be here. I was waiting for you to pick up the next step, but sorry about that.
No problem. Warren, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
I'm doing real well, especially because I'm looking forward to talking with you.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Really appreciate it. I think it's going to be a great conversation and help a lot of people out. So Warren, for those who don't know who you are and what you do, can you please give a brief elevator pitch synopsis about who you are, what you do, and your general background?
Sure. My background in this area started out at being on the board of directors of the National Organization for Women in New York City and speaking all around the world on behalf of women's issues. And then I started to form the National Organization for Women asked me to be on their board of directors after I had started a number of men's consciousness raising groups that they felt were really helpful to men. And we had a lot of people really deeply involved in those groups, including John Lennon, the singer. And so it was a very fascinating journey. And then I began to see in the 1970s, there were a lot of divorces. And those divorces were leading to children not having their father with them, and those children doing particularly poorly. And I started to look into what was happening there and started getting into understanding and developing communication issues, and also seeing that it wasn't just women that were having problems, it was also boys and men that were having problems. And that, and unfortunately, we in the feminist movement had sort of created this hierarchical structure of saying that men had all the privileges and women had all the sacrifices. When, you know, I found that, you know, being expected to go to each generation's war and die in war was not exactly a privilege, but we were, you know, we had it sold to us as if it was a privilege to be willing to serve your country, which, fair enough, it, in some levels it is. But it's also, you know, the end of you as a person many times, or you come back with PTSD and you don't, you're only half the person you were when you went there to war. And so there was not an understanding on the part of feminists that about the types of sacrifices that men made. And we were told that we made more money in our careers, and therefore we had more male privilege. But in fact, making more money was often as a result of sacrificing doing something that we really wanted to do, like being an elementary school teacher, a musician, a podcast host, which doesn't make, you know, usually millions of dollars per year. And then, you know, giving up those things that are fulfilling and doing something once we had children that would help support our wife and children to a greater degree. And we in the feminist movement were not recognizing those types of sacrifices that men made at all. And so I began to start to articulate the challenges that I experienced boys and men having based on my starting some 300 men's groups. And when I did that, when I spoke up about those and I added those to the challenges that women were having, still always supporting women, my standing ovations dropped off. I was a finalist apparently for the MacArthur Genius Award, and as soon as it, you know, turned, as soon as it was heard inside the ranks of the selection that I was also supporting Boys and Men, I got dropped out of that, you know, and just used to write a lot for the New York Times. And as soon as I started defending and talking about, you know, what Boys and Men's issues were, that ended, and on and on and on. And so it was, you know, and so the more things like that happened, the more I realized it was necessary to resist that propensity to define the world in terms of men the oppressors and women the oppressed.
Really appreciate that one. There's just so many layers to that, and we're going to get to all of that throughout the episode. And one of the reasons why I found you, and one of the reasons why I'm really excited about talking to you, is that you wrote a book called The Boy Crisis. I'm co-authored with John Gray, and that book was such an eye-opening read to all the things that you're talking about, what we're going to be talking about today, about so many issues that are facing so many men today. So my question to you is, what made you decide to write that book? What was the background behind you deciding to talk about the boy crisis?
When I was speaking around the world on other books that I was writing, like Why Men Are the Way They Are, teachers would come up to me. I remember that one of the first ones was a woman in Japan, a teacher in Japan. And she said, you know, Dr. Farrell, I'm very fascinated by everything you're saying about women's issues. But, you know, in my classroom, year after year for the last 5 or 6 years, it's been the boys that have been having the bigger struggles. And she said, you know, have you thought about that? Have you talked about that? And then I'd go to Australia and New Zealand and UK and Canada, and I'd hear the same things. And then I would notice the same thing was happening in the United States. And I was, so I started looking into that and seeing that at some level, we've known this ever since the Moynihan Report in 1965, that when the Moynihan Report came out in 1965, Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan was assigned the task of finding out why there was such crime in inner cities. And so we started studying that, and everybody, you know, was sort of like on the edge of their seat thinking, oh my goodness, he's going to be blaming this on Black people. And so as he investigated, he found out the issue was not Black people. The issue was that 25% in 1965, 25% of children who were being brought up without dads. And it wasn't the 75% of children who were being brought up with dads that were having problems. It was the 25% of children being brought up without dads, but particularly the males, the boys, who had no male role model. The girls at least had a female role model, and girls knew how to express their feelings, and mothers would be responsive to their feelings. And so they at least had something to work with without a dad. Although the girls did have more than 50 developmental problems when they didn't have dads, but the boys had those 50 plus developmental problems to a much greater degree when they didn't have father involvement. And that led the boys often to have their testosterone not channeled constructively, but channeled destructively. And without a father at home, and then they'd go to a school where they didn't have good male role models or had no male role models in elementary school oftentimes, the boy without a male role model at home or at school was very vulnerable to being told by a gang leader, "Hey, join us. You know, we'll really make you into something. You'll have a family here. We'll all stand behind you." Or a drug dealer saying, "You know, listen, I know you're not very successful, but you know, we can get you money real fast. And you'll be able to buy a car. You'll be able to really look cool. The girls will be really interested in you." And so, you know, the vulnerability to channeling one's testosterone destructively was much greater. And so, as early as 1965, Daniel Patrick Moynihan saw this pattern. But now, in current day, that the percentage of Black children that are brought up without dads is no longer 25%. It's now 72%. And the Caucasian population being brought up without dads is now 32%. It used to be 3.1%. And so we have in both the Caucasian, the Hispanic, and the African-American population, we have this enormous issue called dad deprivation. Now, the boy crisis, I found, has 10 causes behind it. But of those 10 causes, by far and away, the most powerful is dad deprivation. And so I then started asking myself, you know, well, what is leading to dad deprivation? It was the lack of father involvement. But what's leading to the lack of father involvement? And oftentimes in married families or with couples that had were raising children together, it was poor communication. So I started doing work on two areas. One was the work that led to the Boy Crisis book, and the other one was a couples communication work to teach people how to be able to handle personal criticism without becoming defensive, so each person would be able to hear each other, so there wouldn't be such anger and defensiveness that led to the divorce that led to the Boy Crisis to begin with.
No, I absolutely love that. And man, that, like, I remember when I was reading that, this was something I've been experiencing and researching and looking up some of the data for years. And I just love how you cohesively put it together in one piece of literature that was able to really speak just so clear and articulately about this issue. And all these things we're definitely going to be getting into this episode, because there's just so many layers upon layers about why all these things have taken place, and so many layers upon layers about how to create tangible solutions. But one of the things that I've noticed is that when it comes to anybody being or attempting to, you know, help men, to help boys, to do all these things, so often it seems as though society paints it like it's a zero-sum game. And so the zero-sum game is that if you want to help men, you therefore hate women. If you want to build up men, you want to tear down women. And I find that so many times this message is being portrayed, even, you know, unfortunately, even sometimes with you. So why is it so that whenever an individual is trying to help men, find tangible solutions to help men or boys, which is going to lead to helping women and society, so many people want to label that person as anti-women or destructive to our society?
Yes. First of all, it's an extremely important question, because as a result of exactly what you're saying, There's no opening starter gate. We can't even leave the gate of getting ourselves looked at empathetically. And, you know, an illustration of your point that is happening right now as we speak is President Biden, the day before he was inaugurated, started a White House Gender Policy Council. And so gender, as I understood it, is two genders, male and female, or more, depending on how you define it, but at least two. And the and so I was very excited about that and said, well, finally, you know, President Obama had only started a White House Council for women and girls. I had tried to get him to start a White House Council on boys and men as well, but he didn't do it for complex reasons. One of them was exactly what you're talking about. And so the next step was, I look at the mission statement of the White House Gender Policy Council, and it's to support women, girls, and mothers. And then it's also to support one other thing, racial justice. But racial justice, when you look at that carefully, the people in the United States who are having the greatest amount of jeopardy is Black males. So and you're not even talking here in the White House Gender Policy Council mission statement. You're talking about racial justice, but you're not talking about helping males. You're not talking about helping fathers. You're not talking about helping boys that are Black. And so that was just astounding to me. So fortunately, I knew the woman who was the co-chair of the White House Gender Policy Council. And she was, and so I contacted her and pointed this out as if it needed pointing out. And she said, oh, don't worry, Dr. Farrell, we're going to be very cognizant of men's and boys' issues. So I said, well, if you're going to be cognizant of men's, boys, and fathers' issues, why don't you write it into the mission statement about being cognizant of that? Because nothing that you're saying or writing about is any indicator of that. Oh, no, it's okay. We'll be very aware of that. Zero responsiveness, just passive aggressiveness. And so that's an example of the degree to which this is taken. Here is a person running for president who said he was going to be inclusive. And this is exclusive. He's going to be healing, but this is not healing. And so everything he promised was being neglected in this area. So then the question that you were asking is, why is this? And it has a number of reasons for it. Historically speaking and biologically speaking, females learned to have sex with the alpha male. The alpha male was one who would be willing to die to protect her. So as each generation had its, had its war, we as males were told, you know, Hafiz, if you want to be a real American and you want to be a real hero, you know, like Jimmy, the white boy down the street, his uncle was in the Marines. Now you could be a real hero like him. So we were getting social bribes to be able to be willing to die and be disposable in order to keep women and other people alive.
What's good, everybody? We're going to take a quick pause from this week's episode because I want to talk to you guys about the Roommates Patreon. Guys, we have a Patreon account where we give you so many amazing tools and resources from so many free additional courses that help you to become the best version of yourself, as well as the accountability sheet where you can connect with so many like-minded men from all around your local community and the world, as well as so many bonus and additional episodes and videos that help you guys get better. Guys, by supporting us on Patreon, you not only help support the movement of men who become better, but you also help us continue to grow the Roommates brand so that more men's lives can be transformed and so many men who don't have any tools can begin to win. So sign up via the link below at patreon.com/roommates. Join the community, get all the tools you need to be successful, and let's get back to this week's episode.
So our positive value being called a hero was dependent upon our disposability. And then we were also told that before women started sharing the economic responsibilities to a greater degree, we were told that we should be willing to sacrifice our lives, climbing up a corporate ladder, becoming giving up jobs that we really love to do for jobs that paid more, and so we learned to be disposable either in war or in the workplace. Now, when men start asking to be paid attention to because of psychological challenges they have, that doesn't make women feel protected. And so there's an underlying biological propensity on the part of both women and men to not be okay with men saying what their challenges are in order to be respected by women or by other men. You have to put on a mask of invulnerability, because we knew that the people who went to war, if you were in boot camp in war and somebody said something anti-Semitic or racist, and you said, sergeant, sir, that seemed very racist to me or very anti-Semitic to me, and the response to you would be, isn't that sweet? Anti-Semitic, racist. Oh, we're going to have a little pouting boy here. And why did he respond that way? Because your purpose was to be disposable as part of the war machine. That war machine did not work well with squeaky wheels. The war machine worked well where everybody just forgot about their own feelings, their own fears, and just were willing to work and be disposable. And women gave us the same message. Lois Lane had no interest in Clark Kent, who expressed feelings. She only had interest in Superman. Now, once she found out he was Superman, then she thought she could add to him helping him express feelings. But zero interest in the person who expressed feelings without first being Superman. And, wow. And you see this in movie after movie and theme after theme and in real life. If you go to a party and you say in real life, let's say you're in college and the woman says to you, what are you planning to do? And you say, I just love kids. I'd like to be maybe either a kindergarten school teacher or, if I marry somebody and we have children, I'd love to be, I think I'd be a great full-time dad. You're going to be making some significant money that way? It doesn't really make that much difference. We can live in a fairly, modest place as long as, the children have love. Oh, that's a really good idea. Yes, indeed. And then she goes back for a drink and sends a journalist your way to talk to the journalist about it, but it doesn't come back to you. And you know, she asks, you know, well, where are you living now? Oh, I'm living in my parents' basement because I really want to, you know, sort of do some things that are really useful. I'm really helping the homeless and doing things like that. That is really sweet. Bye. You know, and so men get this message in a thousand different ways. And this is not blaming women, because women have learned to value the alpha male, because the alpha male did the best protecting of not only her, but the children. Her job was to protect the children. Her job was to be willing to die for the children. His job was historically to be willing to die for her and the children. But no one's job was to be willing to die for the man living. Mm. His job was to die for others. And so this is deep-seated in every animal we have this. 85% of animals, the female reproduces with the alpha male. So a very fascinating story of this is what happens with buck elks. So the female buck elk wants to, she finds which male buck elk has the biggest rack. And she wants to have her sex and reproduction with him, because he'll be able to protect her from unwanted suitors and be able to protect the children from predators. And so she finds the rack with the buck elk with the biggest rack, and she has sex with him, and they reproduce. And then that buck elk, in order to get that biggest rack, has to he has exhausted 30% of his minerals, his calcium, and his nutrients. So if he doesn't get rid of that rack immediately, he is likely to die before winter sets in, because he doesn't have enough time to replenish his nutrients. So the motto of that is that the male weakness is his facade of strength. What it took for him to be that super alpha male was the exhaustion of everything that really made him strong. But it wasn't the concern of the female to have him reveal the weaknesses that he was feeling as he was getting the big rack. It was the concern of her to find the male with the biggest rack so she could protect her children. And that goes through all animals, from insects right on up through humans. And so we have something very deep that we're dealing with here, and which is why we need to not be blaming women or blaming ourselves, but something that for the first time in human history, in the 53 largest developed nations, there's enough mastery of survival in the middle and upper middle class that we can have different senses of purpose other than just dying to have the other sex survive. And that's what we really need to aim for now. Yes, is masculinity toxic? Lots of portions of masculinity are toxic. Lots of portions of masculinity are not toxic. But the result of the toxicities do not come from male privilege and male power. They come from male powerlessness.
Wow. That's absolutely powerful, man. There's so much, man. I mean, it's like we can literally have five different podcasts for 5 hours each about everything that we've even said from the introduction. So I had a way I wanted to go, but you took the conversation a whole different direction. But I want to stay where you're taking this conversation, because I kid you not, I literally, what you described about Clark Kent and Lois Lane, I literally had a video about that. And everything that you described, I talked about it in a video, and the themes is exactly similar. What you see in almost every single animal, as you shared, and what you see especially in society, is that, you know, when it comes to male desirability, there are certain skills that women desire. You know, these are usually masculine skills: power, dominance, strength, assertiveness, confidence, competence, initiative. All these skills are masculine skills that women desire. But what's never talked about is, what does it take to get these skills, right? You want somebody on the top of the hierarchy in regard to the workplace. But what did that man have to do in order to get to the top? You want somebody who's driven, who is ambitious, but how did that change this individual? And so one of the biggest things that I saw was that so many times the things, you know, that society would label men for being evil about were the very things society needed men to do for society to thrive. And one of the things I thought about was when it comes to big predators, you know, like human civilization, whether it was saber-toothed tigers, whether it was, you know, snakes in the Amazon, wherever it was, there were large predators that could kill us. And so what ended up happening was that what you needed was strong, powerful, fearless men to go and fight and kill these big predators to keep us safe. And so when you have generation after generation of, like you said, disposable warriors that you call to keep us safe and to cultivate this world and to battle these predators, what is going to become of them? How are they going to be molded? How are they going to be shaped? And so what I see and what I've noticed is that society benefited from the machine that they made men to be. We wouldn't be here without all the men who sacrificed their lives, blood, sweat, and tears, you know, to be able to civilize society from just a nature perspective. I'm not even getting to, you know, wars and things like along those lines. But then after that, now after using these men to be these war machines to civilize society, now we want to demonize them for what we require them to be.
Yes.
And so to me, what you described is something that I was thinking about the other day. And what it seems to me is that there is not much compassion to what men are going through. And you made a great point that what happens so many times in the world is that we understand that women and children deserve to be protected. We understand that if a woman is crying on the side of the road, there's something wrong, and then we as a society must come around her to love her, to support her, to lift her up. But when we see men on the side of the road crying, there's no sympathy that's elicited towards individual.
Absolutely.
We tell that guy to get back up and to make it happen. Mm-hmm. There's no talk show for men to cry and to share about their feelings and what's going on. We have no sympathy for this man. And so what I've been seeing is that when it comes to so many of these men who are struggling, especially in today's world, there is absolutely no sympathy for what they're dealing with. And we as a society have not taken responsibility by saying we needed you to be these machines and now you're suffering because of it.
Absolutely right. There's so many levels of addressing that question. One is, you know, on the pure empathy level. We know that men used to be 5.2 years sooner in the last year or two. With COVID, it's increased to 5.4 years sooner than women do. And we know that we just haven't heard this 40% greater increase in life expectancy or decrease in life expectancy for men. We haven't heard that because it's men that are hurting. So that type of absence is there. There's so many things that are going on simultaneously, and I'll address two very important dimensions of that. So we often hear that men who are very successful at work, they pull women in. Let's say a man's a CEO. But oftentimes the woman, once she marries that CEO or that sort of superstar in whatever area, actor or a politician, she often notices she's not listened to very carefully by that man. And so she feels this internal tension between the fact that all her friends are saying, my goodness, you've married the president of this company or that company, and God, you live in this gorgeous home, and you have the kids in the best school. But underneath, she's not feeling very heard because no one points out to her or to the society as a whole that the qualities it takes to become successful at work are in tension with the qualities it takes to be successful in love. And I'll explain what I mean by that. If I'm a CEO and somebody's coming to me, let's say, to sell me an engine for let's say I'm a CEO at Boeing Aircraft, and they're saying, we have the very best engine that you can buy, that we want Boeing to buy. And so I have to start listening as a CEO, is, you know, who are the competitors to this person? Do I know all the competitors? How is my infrastructure built in China? What about Southeast Asia? Which ones can most adapt to this? What's the history of this person? I have to be asking a dozen questions like that. And those questions are zipping around in my mind while that female or male representative, sales representative, is talking. If I don't do that, I'm not doing my job as a CEO. But if I take that skill set back home, and my wife is saying, I had a tough day at work today, or tough day with the kids today, and I'm thinking to my, and you know, I really don't know what to do, and I'm thinking in my mind's eye, okay, now I can solve this problem. Here's what she should do. And I'm thinking about all the things she can do to solve this problem while she's talking. She does not feel heard. Because what it took me to be successful as a CEO was to problem solve, was to be listening to possible solutions in my mind while she was talking or he was talking, the person selling me the product. But at home, what it takes to deepen love is not to solve a problem, but to hear the woman or your children talking to you about their problem, to empathize with how much that must be painful and what a challenge it must be, how much and recognize the barriers and be there for them. And then once those barriers are recognized, then that gives them permission to feel like they're loved, they're nurtured, they're felt, they're supported emotionally, and then they might ask you, what can I do to solve the problem? But in my opinion, what I train people, men in particular, to do in couples communication is, even when the woman asks you for a solution, say, I'm happy to offer some thoughts, but what are some thoughts that you have? Because the more you ask her to or your children to come forth and solve their own problems, the more you're showing respect for them. And so when you've emotionally supported them and then you're drawing them out to solve their own problems, that's when you your wife or your children feel most loved, most honored, most respected by you. I've talked about this in a number of the books that I've written, Women Can't Hear What Men Don't Say and in the Boy Crisis, but I don't see any other part of society helping women understand this or helping men even understand what they lose with their gain. So another example of this from what you were saying, you were talking about how we solve problems, but nobody appreciates it. So let me just ask the woman or the man that is listening to this podcast, just to look up at your ceiling in your house and to see, you know, think to yourself, who built that house? Who constructed that ceiling? That was a construction worker who is almost invariably a male that was up building the roof of that house, putting in the windows, building the foundations. But they got that wood from a logger. A logger is the most dangerous profession in the United States. And then that logger, when he took the log, took down the logs at the risk of his own life, gave it to a trucker. And the trucker is another one of the most dangerous occupations in the United States, who took it across country, sometimes falling asleep on the second or third job and crashing and hurting other people as well, who then took it to a yard near you, who then sold it to some construction worker. And so every step of that way were people risking their lives so you could have that roof over your head. You know, right now we are, you and I are operating on this type of technology that was unavailable to us years ago. But this is technology that was built to a very large degree by men who took risks. And for each Steve Jobs or Gates or Zuckerberg who took risks, there's 100 or 1,000 who took risks and failed. We see the successful ones who succeeded from their garage to becoming the Zuckerbergs of the Jobs or the Gates, but we don't see the ones that tried in that garage and never got there. And this comes as a result of risk-taking that men do. And so oftentimes women are not being trained today to share that risk taking. So, for example, we have Governor Cuomo at this moment being cross-examined for all the ways he harassed women in his work environment. That is really I'm very glad we're hearing from women about what offends them and what hurts them. He needs to know that. The world needs to know that. But we are not training girls in school to share those risks of sexual rejection. We're only training boys to reach out and take those risks still. But if they take them too quickly, they're a sexual harasser. If they don't take them quickly enough, they're a wimp. And so if we really wanted to empower our daughters, we'd be saying, it is your responsibility to take the risks of sexual rejection about half the time. When you do that, you'll be getting the man you want. That will be original choice power for you. You'll have your original choice of the type of man you want. You won't have to wait back and have veto power only. You won't depend on taking risk by flirting or by wearing something that is a low-cut dress and then wondering why 20 to 25 men approach you looking at your breasts while you are only interested in one of those men and you have to reject 24 of them. And so we're not empowering women by asking them to take the risks. And when we don't ask women to take the risk when they're 14, 15, and 16, they're not prepared to take the risk in work situations or in life, and therefore make the type of money as a result of taking those risks. So we're underappreciating the men. We're not training the women to be genuinely equal to the men, and so these are just a few of the examples of what neither men nor women are understanding about how to make themselves better, both internally and also relationship-wise.
Nah, man. Oh, man. I don't even know what. Well, man, Warren, you're killing it today, man. You are. Woo! Literally, I'm being overwhelmed. Like, when I was watching your episode with Dr. Jordan Peterson, I kid you not, every 5 minutes you talk, I had to pause it, do a lap around the house, take a bunch of notes. I was so overwhelmed, and now I'm feeling just equally as overwhelmed talking to you because there's just so much that you've said. Let's talk about that risk-taking point because I absolutely love that point because I want to reiterate this point. Is one of the things I've always said is human beings are not perfect.
That's for sure. That's a statement with which no one would argue.
Of course. And so what ends up happening is everybody falls on one end of the spectrum, right? So generally speaking, let's just say proactivity, passivity, right? Too assertive, too passive. You're either going to fall on one end of the spectrum. When women desire a man to be assertive, usually that means he can lean to the extreme of assertiveness to, let's say, being a bully, right? That is the extreme version of it. But then if he's passive, the extreme version of passive is being a doormat, right? And so one of the things that I've realized is that when you want somebody to be one thing, there's going to be a tendency because you're asking him to be assertive or asking them to be passive, they're going to lean a little bit more to an extreme, which they got to do a constant, you know, seesaw to balance it out. How is that? Why is that important? When it comes to risk, what you see, and now we're tying into your conversation about rough and tumble play, especially with young boys. When young boys play, young boys are very risky. I was a preschool teacher as well as a middle school and high school teacher. I also coached middle school and high school football, and I was an after-school teacher for elementary school. So I dealt with young males and females across the whole gamut. Young boys are extremely risky when it comes to how they play, how they develop, how they interact with one another. And what happens in society is that now a lot of that risk is seen to be toxic masculine behaviors. And a lot of what parents, especially mothers and people in society, are trying to do is to stop boys from being so risky in their play. But what I find interesting, Warren, is that though society for so many years, especially my generation, Generation Z, and then of course, you know, the next generation right now, what you see is that now what women are complaining about is men being too passive, men not being initiators, men not doing the exact risky things that's required to be able to attract a partner, to be able to move up the workplace, to be able to garner respect. So what they've done is that they like the lions to be able to have claws and be able to roar. But then when the lion is a cub, they want to cut off all his claws and they want to tell him that roaring is bad.
Yeah.
And so it's so unfortunate that that is something I constantly am seeing, is that you made so many great points. There's so many things that society wants men to do. And there's so many expectations that they're not giving women. They're not giving women these giving men these expectations. But then when these young men are boys, they're being penalized for this kind of behavior, to now where when they're older, they're so passive and they're so afraid of taking risks that now none of the women desire them, and now they're being shipped off to the outskirts of our society.
Yes, yes, you're absolutely right. And we see this, you know, as an elementary and a high school teacher, you've seen real life examples of this all the time. When you're at school as a teacher and you bring this up to your staff, which are probably mostly female colleagues, and you're in elementary school in particular, what is the response that you get?
I mean, Warren, you talked about it in your book. The responses you would get is that, no, this is not good. This is not how you're supposed to behave. Now, this kid is problematic. You know, this kid is this. You talk about it, put him on ADHD medicine. The response is so much negative pushback because they think that you're just allowing these rampant boys. And what they say is, how come they can't do what the girls do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If the girls can sit down, listen, and do that, and they don't need recess, they don't need their playtime, why can't the boys do that as well? So you're seeing, what you see from so many of the women staff, which are mainly the principals, vice principals, and also your fellow teachers, you see so much of a pushback in regards to the way that as a man you understand how males should be raised and developed.
You're exactly right, and you know, certainly when I did the research for the boy crisis, I found male after male, and you know, who did have the guts to speak up, soon recognized that he was cast as being, you know, anti-female, or setting up the situation by which bullies were created, and certainly, you know, every virtue taken to its extreme becomes a vice, but the job is to have that checks and balances between, you know, what kids learn when they roughhouse is what roughhousing becomes aggressive, what is assertive, what is clever, what is ingenious, what is, your roughhousing with your sister and brother, and you stick your elbow in your sister's eye, what's not okay. And so from that, you learn social skills. And, you know, you're playing, when I was growing up, we used to play dodgeball a lot. And, you know, and now dodgeball is eliminated in most schools. And, or we tease each other a lot. If you and I were on the school ground together and we were, playing and we were the same age, you know, I'd figure out every way of making fun of you. You'd figure out every way of making fun of me. And so now today that would be considered cruel. But no one understands is, what were we doing? What we were doing is preparing each other to be able to handle criticism, because being able to handle criticism without becoming defensive was a prerequisite to being able to be successful in life. And so we take this into the workplace. And I think what I'm going to say now, I think every man and woman can really benefit from. We're in the workplace, and if we're all guys in the workplace, you'll rib me. The commerce of masculinity is the trading of wit-covered put-downs. So I'll put you down, you'll put me down, but I'll only put you down and you'll put me down after there's enough trust between the two of us that we have that you have a good sense of humor. You're not a little prima donna who's going to fall apart at the first bit of put down. And when I begin to invite you into my circle of friends is when I begin to test you out to see whether a put down is meant with being offended or a put down is meant with you responding with the put down and us, you know, working on the wit and having fun with each other. And so the point there is we do that with each other as a testing grounds to see who is going to be admitted to the club of our acceptance. But we do that with a female at work. And the female may say, you know, we just say, oh, gee, you have a really nice dress on, or your hair looks great, or you look really beautiful today. And the woman might report that to HR. And HR goes, oh, my goodness, that must have made you feel very uncomfortable. And the woman says, yeah, I feel like, you know, they wouldn't have said that to a guy. You know, why are they saying that to me? That must be a sense of discrimination against me. And, you know, and she has a genuine hurt or, you know, challenge. HR is not really HR, which stands for human resources. It's really HER, which means her complaints are heard. And he's considered to be the, the oppressor. And so he may get demoted or, you know, get at least a lecture or get fired for what he did, even sometimes without being heard from his perspective. And so what is happening for many women who are not learning the positive intent of this wit-covered put-downs being traded as part of the price of admission to being desired by each other, is that the woman feels rejected, and that makes her feel that undermines her work feeling good at work. But what should really happen there? If HR was really human resources, there'd be a dialogue between the male sharing his intent and being able to even learn from HR an understanding of why he did those wit-covered put-downs. And that the testing grounds of it, about whether it was comfortable or uncomfortable, here are the cues that will tell you that it's comfortable or not comfortable for somebody. And so there we could benefit, because who's right or who's wrong about the wit-covered put-downs? Both are right and both are wrong. Really, nobody's right and nobody's wrong. It's a different style of communicating with each other. Both genders need to know each other's style, what hurts, what doesn't hurt. And when a woman hears that, you know, that wit-covered, put-down is really his way of respecting her, that feels very different than if she feels it's his way of disrespecting her.
Mm-hmm. No, that's really good. And one of the things I've noticed that you've shared, and I, even after reading your book, even when going to the chapters about, you know, men being raised by single mothers, what I've learned is that so many men understand the world that women live in, and I shared this to people before, and some people agree, some people don't, but what I shared was that most men, let's just take in the Black community, 72% of men in the Black community or people, children in the Black community, are raised by single mothers. So you're raised with a woman at home. So most males understand how women think, generally speaking, how, you know, the uniqueness of how women interact, how the women communicate. There is a understanding of women and their uniquenesses and their differences from us. But what happens is for so many women, going back to women raised in that same 72% single mother community, there's not an understanding of the uniqueness of men, mm-hmm. because there's not a lot of men around.
Yes.
Because there may be male brothers around, but there's not a lot of, there's not men who are active in your life. Your teachers are usually not going to be men. The people hanging around your family, your mother is going to be her sisters and her friends, not going to be men. So there's not an understanding of men, male behavior and uniquenesses like that. So what I find is consistently, because the way men behave is different, that difference is demonized.
Yes. Yeah.
And because that difference is demonized, now going back to the lion example I gave previously, Well, the female lion does not have a mane. The male lion has a mane. But imagine the female lion growing up and seeing her young cub being raised and growing his mane and saying, well, that's different. So you need to remove that. That's kind of what I see happening in society. The differences that make men men, which helps benefit society, protect women, protect children, all these things, these unique differences in how we interact and how we behave are now being demonized.
Yes.
And what ends up happening is not only do women demonize this behavior, but now you have a community of men who demonize it as well. And in your book, there was a chapter where it was really, it was so powerful to me about the young man who thought that being a male, he was afraid to be a man. And he thought, oh my gosh, now that I'm a man, I'm now the villain. And so now this message of all these uniqueness of being a man, it has such a negative connotation. And so what you're seeing consistently is all these things, whether it's the jokes, whether it's a rough and tumble play, whether it's, you know, different things along those lines, these things are slowly being removed from the men. And now what you're seeing is a generation of men who now have, in all honesty, gone to the other extreme, where if before they were, you know, these macho, quote unquote, tyrannical figures, now they're very passive, you know, weak individuals who really cannot stand for themselves, let alone the people in their lives. And so I just see it hurts me so much that these conversations are not happening, where women and men can talk about the uniquenesses of one another without demonizing the other gender.
Absolutely. Fortunately, you are doing this. But I wanted to make sure that I realize that there are going to be some women listening to this too, and some women who are single mothers. And oftentimes when I talk about how important boys are, men are, and fathers are in children's lives, and boys' lives in particular, a single mother feels like, oh, what can I do? You know, maybe I can just end with sharing a few things that can be done so that
the single mother has
some possibilities. First is, spend some time with the portions of the Boy Crisis book that talk about the different ways that dads and moms tend to parent, and study the differences, the roughhousing, the wit-covered put-downs, the teasing, things like that, what their purposes of those things are. And as you value those things, if you share with the biological dad that you do value those things, men come around when they feel needed, and they disappear when they feel unneeded. And so your first job is to make sure that the man who is the biological dad of your son feels needed. Now, if it's absolutely impossible to get him back, or he's really totally hopeless, even after you've said how much you value him, but don't assume that until you have valued him in a very specific way, then what next? What next is to make sure your son has other mentors to mentor him, that people that you respect. Invite those mentors over for dinner. Make it clear that you're looking for that mentor not to be sexual with you that evening, but rather to be a good mentor for your son. Make sure that he gets involved with Cub Scouts. Cub Scouts have a very strong record of developing character in boys that attend Cub Scouts frequently. Make sure he gets involved with Boy Scouts if he's a little bit older. Make sure he gets involved with sports, not just team sports, but team sports, but what I call the liberal arts of sports, team sports, pick up team sports, and also sports where he has to do individual work, like in gymnastics or tennis, where it's not only the team that is the issue, it's the self-development that's the issue, wrestling and so on. Those are important things to involve him in. Make sure that he is not only has somebody to mentor him, but find somebody who's younger than he is, who's having challenges, to work to have him be the mentor of that boy. Statistically speaking, boys progress the most when they have a responsibility to take care of somebody else. And then when they think about maybe taking drugs or not doing their homework or goofing off, they think to themselves, well, how will that look to this boy who I'm telling to do all these positive things? I'm telling him to do his homework and I'm not doing my own. That will make me lose cred as a mentor. So he starts doing the homework he didn't do before, even when he had a mentor that was telling him to do that homework. And so that is a very important dimension. So in the Boy Crisis book, I talk a great deal about what each person can do to bring up their children the best, and especially pay attention to family dinner nights and the importance of family dinner nights being constructed in such a way that they don't become family dinner nightmares, to help each boy and mother and father feel heard and listened to. You started to say something.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry for cutting you off. There's just two quick questions I want to ask you before we wrap it up. The first question, I love what you said about the single mothers, but what about the men who are, if not single fathers, or they're married to their spouses, who don't feel an ability to be able to have tangible, hands-on some time with their children? You know, maybe the mother's not letting them, you know, have time, and they know that it's important. They read your book, they hear this conversation, you know that they need to be involved in their young son's lives. What is your advice to a man who's dealing with a woman who does not want him to be as involved in his son's life? What are tangible things he can do, or some of the conversations he can have, to be able to, you know, allow that woman to see the importance of him that need in his child's life?
Yes. First, read The Boy Crisis with an eye to underlining the portions of it that your wife will understand, what the mother will understand and feel empathized with. So let her know that this is not a book that will make her wrong and him right. Then, secondly, take a look at those chapters on the differences between male and female style parenting, dad and mom style parenting. And look at the types of things that your wife will be interested in. So, for example, I've never heard a man say to a woman, one of the reasons I want to roughhouse with our children is to teach them to be more empathetic. That's about as counterintuitive as it can be. Roughhousing leading to empathy. But take a look and see why roughhousing does, the way most men do roughhousing in a positive way, why it leads to empathy. Why it leads to social skills, the children understanding the difference between being assertive versus aggressive. Why roughhousing done well leads to postponed gratification, and why postponed gratification is the single biggest predictor of success or failure. When your wife begins to see that the things she values, like empathy, like social skills, like postponed gratification, like success versus failure, are things that you care about, and that your dad-style parenting or helping your children get exactly what she cares about, then she will feel heard, and she will see that you are really a caring, conscious parent who is doing things like the roughhousing, that not because you're just one more kid she has to monitor, but rather because you are a thoughtful adult who really has read and thought about these things, and that you have a different role, but a very compatible role in this process, that you as parents, like when you, and some of those things will be a natural area of tension. When should the child climb the tree? How high should the child climb the tree? But the children who do the best in the research I've done for the Boy Crisis are the ones who have checks and balance parenting. A deeply involved dad and a deeply involved mom who says, okay, the children can climb that tree, but not above this level and not these weak branches there. And you've got to be out there under the tree, ready to cushion them if they fall. And please give me the iPhone so you're not preoccupied while they might be falling. And so you negotiate with your wife a combination of safety that the children need and risk-taking that actually increases your son's and daughter's IQ when they learn to take risks at the right level. And so those are just examples.
I love it. And in closing, man, we could go on for days, but I want to be respectful of your time, man. This is just such an amazing conversation. I've learned so much. But one of the things I always ask men who are involved in male development is I always ask them a similar question. One of the biggest things that I've seen that there's a lot of guys who are, they're now men who suffer due to the boy crisis. All the things you talked about in the books, all the things that went on in society that we talked about today, they are the firsthand casualties of this new social experiment to create a new generation of men. And so these men have little purpose. These men are unmotivated. These men are struggling in life. So if there's a guy right now, let's say he's 25 years old, he's living with his mother, he does barely graduate high school, he doesn't have much tangible skills, but after hearing this podcast and hearing about what you've communicated today, he wants to build his life up, he wants to get up, he wants to be able to be a productive, strong member of society. What are tangible steps that you can give a man like that who is right now at rock bottom to be able to build his life and become the man that he's called to be?
Yes. First, see if there's any chance of getting your biological father involved in the raising of you. Then call him, do everything you can to connect with him. Tell him that you need him. When I ran for governor of California and I spoke to prison populations, and almost all the males in prison were males that did not have very much or any father involvement. And when I told them how important they were as fathers, men who were strong as you are, like football player type of strength, having muscles I'll never have, they would come up to me and pull me aside, and tears would start coming out of their eyes and saying, "I always thought I just deserved to be in prison, that I was the loser. Now that I realize that I can be a really great dad and save my children from making the mistakes that I make, I have for the first time in my life an incentive to live, an incentive to get out of prison as soon as I can, and to get home and to take care of my children and prevent them from making the mistakes I've made." Find your dad. If you can't find your dad, get involved with sports. Even if you're not good at the sport, just allow yourself to get better and better. Begin to exercise, eat really well. Make sure that you have the underlying energy to be able to feel motivated. Ask for help. Get involved with a faith-based community. Ask your faith-based leader to get you involved with boys who are your age, to talk privately and confidentially about the things that are bothering them, particularly other boys that don't have father involvement. To find a coach who will really care for you, not just care for winning, but care for you. And so those are just a few of the many things. One of my real commitments in writing The Boy Crisis is to not ever express any problem that I don't have multiple solutions for. So I really appreciate your asking for those solutions.
I love it. Well, Dr. Warren, it was such an opportunity, such a blessing. I really appreciate you taking time out of your day to speak into the life of young men. Where can people find you at?
My website is warrenferrell.com. Ferrell is spelled, I'm not like Will Ferrell, not that funny. it's not F-E-R, but F-A-R-R-E-L-L.com. And my email address is locatable through warrenferrell.com. I always enjoy and respond to every single email I get. And the Boy Crisis book is on sale now on Amazon. So feel free to, and if you don't have much money, just get a used copy for practically nothing on Amazon.
Sounds great. Guys, you know how we get down. Please send Warren a message via his website. Let him know what about this episode stood out to you guys so much. Make sure you guys get The Boy Crisis. And like he said, please, please, if you need help, seek help. Find like-minded men to be able to come alongside you. You know we have our accountability and all types of resources on Patreon to help you guys so much. My name is Hafiz, and I'm joined by
Warren Ferrell. But Hafiz, it was such a pleasure.
We are the roommates, and have a great day.